Hello again, and everybody, and welcome to another episode of BitNote. This is David Collins, where we'll be playing video game music, so have a listen and hope you enjoy. So, to start off this episode on something of a sad note, we note the passing of Satoru Iwata. He was the president of Nintendo, and more than that, he was a gamer who loved games and did so much to further gaming and fun and great times and good memories and so many people. It's hard to even describe exactly his contributions. In fact, I was a little guilty of not quite following him that much and just being kind of more of the Sega person that I am, and so, you know, didn't really pay much attention to Nintendo. But the outpouring of sympathy and support and memories that I've seen since his death has just showed his huge legacy among gamers, among developers, and just among people who love gaming as a whole, and I definitely think that's worth remembering. Iwata was born in 1959, and he got involved in gaming in the 80s when he joined a company called HAL. He always loved games, and during the 80s, he worked, despite the fact working in a separate company, he worked pretty much with Nintendo, and he's worked on so many games in collaboration with them. He was a true programmer, working on things like Balloon Flight, NES Open Tournament, Earthbound. And he was even instrumental in developing the Kirby games, getting it that major series to get its start that it deserved. The actual designer of Kirby was Mashiro Sakurai, but it was Iwata whose technical prowess just really helped develop the Kirby and make it what it was. His huge degrees of experience and knowledge was just pretty much amazing. At times, he basically helped save the Earthbound gaming franchise, and then for the Pokemon Gold and Silver games, he basically developed new compression algorithms and stuff. There were times when even if the developers of the actual game were having trouble, and he just joined in and helped. And he would do this even when he eventually became president of HAL. And he basically became president of HAL because the company was about to pretty much, the writing was on the wall. Everyone thought the whole company would close. But he became president and then managed to turn the company around, which is amazing. He continued on, and at the turn of the millennium, he became involved more in Nintendo. And then in 2002, he took over from long-term president of Nintendo, Hiroshi Yamauchi. Now, Yamauchi had been president of Nintendo for half a century. He knew so much of what was going on, but he dealt with so many different trials and knew how completely volatile the industry was and everything. He searched a lot of time, but he'd seen Iwata's experience. He knew how he dealt with so many technical things, managerial stuff, and he believed that he was the best person from the job. And indeed, I think few will dispute that notion. Iwata showed a huge commitment. He realized that gaming was changing a lot, but he realized that he wanted, that despite how a lot of games are getting more and more complex with higher and higher budgets, he wanted to try to make it a bit more simpler, which was a courageous step because making simple games when everything's going more and more complex is tricky. But it gave Nintendo a bit more freedom to, you know, and more money, and just made the game more made the industry more profitable. But it also ensured that he made fun games and such. And he dealt with a lot of different challenging circumstances over his 10 years plus. Sometimes he's been criticized, of course, Nintendo. Sometimes for focusing too much on the past. Sometimes for sticking with old ideas, both in terms of, you know, in terms of not going up in more modern stuff like online gaming, or even just in terms of, you know, game design. And sometimes, recently, there's been comments about the portable system. But while there has been criticism, there's no doubt that Nintendo has gone from strength to strength. And while it's had some problems recently with the Wii U, generally it was clear that Iwata was wanting to get it back on track and just get it moving. He was first and foremost a gamer who loved games. He described it himself. It was literally on his business card. That is what he loved. And he loved Nintendo, and loved the fans of Nintendo. He got involved in Nintendo Direct, starting it up, where basically people involved in Nintendo would just basically appear in these humorous little videos that they'd show directly to the fans. And I think that's what a lot of Nintendo fans got involved with Iwata himself, because they saw him first and foremost center right in front of them, just having a fun time. And it just showed that games are about a lot of things. I mean, Iwata doesn't even summarize everything. But I think that while it's a huge travesty to just try to summarize everything and say it's all about this or it's about that, I think Iwata represents a lot about it, that we go forward, we act with love, but we play practical considerations, we make decisions, and sometimes people aren't happy with it. But if we make enough of them and we do enough, there's clearly so many people who'll appreciate it, so many people who'll get it going. And I think Iwata himself was one of the people who really appreciated it and loved what he was doing, and that's so important. In fact, when Nintendo hit some troubled times, he even cut his own salary. The president of a company cutting his own salary in order to help the company. That's how much he loved what he was doing and the people involved with it. So, with that said, there's been a lot of games he's been involved with. I'm not really sure I could just point to a single game that he, well, except Kirby, of course, which had its own thing. But I was thinking I've got to play it. I wanted to play a track from a game to really represent it, but it was just tricky because there were a lot of games involved. But then something, in a way, beautiful happened. It was posted on the internet that the day after he died, a rainbow appeared over Nintendo HQ. And it was beautiful, and some fans talked about how this was effectively the Rainbow Road to Heaven. Rainbow Road refers to a level that pops up in Mario Kart. Mario Kart is a long saga, so there are many different incarnations of Rainbow Road. So the idea of just fans just showing that this staple, this beautiful symbol of one of such a beloved series of games from Nintendo, was quite an appropriate thing to connect with Iwata. Like driving that little rainbow road and hopefully not falling off, because that rainbow road could get really, really tricky at times. But regardless, I decided that seemed to be the best thing to do. Play the music from Rainbow Road to celebrate, well, to eulogize, to commemorate the passing of such an amazing person and such a person who meant a lot. And of course, I had to choose which one to take, because just like everything, there's many different versions of Rainbow Road. But I found this one from the Nintendo 64, and I think it sums it up best. This was composed by Kenta Nagata. It is the Rainbow Road theme. It is from Mario 64 and was developed by Nintendo. So, with that said, Iwata, thank you for everything. Thank you for, even what you've given, maybe even people who didn't quite appreciate it or quite know or just enjoyed the games and didn't think about or realize that the great people behind them. But thank you for also for sticking with what you loved, for living a life that you was meaningful to you, that you wanted to have the best thing, that gave you joy and gave you happiness. And I think that that's one of the great things that we really truly appreciate about you. You did what you made something that made you happy and you loved, and you made so many happy and loved in the process. I'll finish this eulogy with playing Rainbow Road. Have a listen. And much like what so much of Iwata gave out to many, many people, he hopes they'd enjoy it. And I hope you enjoy this. Thank you, Iwata. Okay, let's moving on to a more positive topic. I think this is kind of thematic because, speaking of people, central figures involved in the game industry, let's move on to another one, Yu Suzuki. I was hoping to talk about this under, you know, under less sad note, but I think it shows that there's still a lot of, for whatever people have passed, there's still a lot of great things in the world, I guess. Sorry. Essentially, something pretty amazing has happened. Speaking of fan love and people wanting things that, you know, excite them and great memories, we've come to the Shenmue franchise. Shenmue is a series of precisely two games, which basically were technically financial failures, but generated a huge cult following and people who love it and know what happens. They were developed during the Dreamcast era, and essentially, they were kind of like set in Japan in the 80s about a guy called Ryo Hazuki. And essentially, he sees his father get murdered in front of him. He wants to get revenge. And despite, because this is Japanese rather than America, whereas in America he'd be gunning down a whole load of bad guys in order to get to the bad guy who conveniently is also part of a lot of bad other guys, instead Shenmue decides to walk the streets of Dewita, which is essentially a small Japanese fishing village, and talk to people trying to get clues. And then when he tries to talk with them, he finds more people to talk with and then get clues. Occasionally something exciting has happened, like almost like an action sequence from an old Jackie Chan movie where he must like pursue someone and jump over things. And in this case, he must press a button really, really fast in order to avoid the obstacles. And then other times, you're finding people and then you suddenly have to like get it becomes a little fighting game where you just, you know, move back, move forward, do all these cool moves in order to beat up all the people who are attacking you. And yeah, I mean, this is developed, Yu Suzuki, who developed Shenmue, was also part of the one of the people who developed the Virtua Fighter franchise, so he knew how to develop a good fighting game mechanic. But I think what a lot of people really liked about Shenmue is that it was just the level of detail. You weren't just, you know, in a Japanese fishing village. You were in a Japanese fishing village. Atmosphere flowed at you from all sides. Every single person you saw on the street was basically their own person. They had a schedule. They had a, like, quick bio if you looked at the fourth disc of the game where you could quickly get a few details about their life. They would never really appear in two places at once unless there are some, like, fuzzy stuff about them making a transition. So you could actually, if you really wanted to be stalkery, you could like follow someone in their route through the entire village from beginning to end and then keep talking with them. And then there'd be some who'd be jerk. There was this kid who anytime he talked about any subject, he'd say, "Hey, you want to play baseball?" or "Hey, you want to play soccer?" And there was this girl who said, no matter what you talked to him about, would say, "I'm sorry, I don't want to talk to strangers." And, you know, technically, if you speak to her enough, you're not a stranger enough, but I don't think she ever saw that logic, so that didn't quite work. And there was just a lot of atmospheric things about it, about Ryo, about his quest, and it just did seem to have an epic scale that was really buoyed up by the true, you know, stuff of what was going on. Now, you might know the reason why I'm bringing this up. Well, because essentially, Yu Suzuki had the Shenmue franchise as a gigantic saga with multiple chapters, and then it turned out he made the first chapter into Shenmue 1, and then he kind of skipped the second chapter. That just took place in a boat. So, you know, there was like a comic that quickly described it. And then made chapters 3 to 5 take place in Shenmue 2. By that Shenmue 2, you'd reached Hong Kong and were doing all this crazy sort of stuff. And like going through the completely decrepit buildings of Kowloon and trying not to fall to your death and stuff. But also seeing a truly expansive and major environment. But the problem is, after the two games, no more after that. Part of the problem was that the games cost so much to create, then creating any more, and hadn't made back their money. In fact, like I said, it would probably have taken them to sell even if every Dreamcast player had bought a copy of the game, it probably wouldn't have made back their money. Then, it probably wouldn't have made, you know, they wouldn't have made back their money, so not exactly financial. Also, they even released Shenmue 2 on the Xbox, but I'm not quite sure how successfully that did. So, essentially, no one really wanted to touch it, but fans for the years wanted another version. And then at E3, on a Sony press conference, it was revealed Shenmue 3 would be revealed as a Kickstarter. which was hooray, 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 you know. Obviously, it was kind of mixed feelings. You hoped that it would just be, you know, some company would just give them all the money and everything. But I think they wanted to see fan support, and they made a Kickstarter. And it raised $6.3 million, which is fantastic. Although, wait, wasn't the original budget like, you know, something like $60 million and everything? And that was... yeah, but the point is, it's exciting. We're going to see our new game, but then we're not quite sure exactly who else is contributing to it. But it's great because Yu Suzuki is there, and he's gonna push it forward. But then again, why isn't he going forward? But right, but the point is, regardless, we're getting a sequel to Shenmue. We're getting Shenmue 3, and that is, boy, it's making me equal parts apprehensive and completely worried, but also excited that this is happening, and also totally worried, and hooray! So, without further ado, let me play a bit of music from Shenmue to celebrate it. I was looking through the track of Shenmue to try to, you know, get some music to celebrate this, and then it turns out they are about, you know, they're two or fantastic orchestral works of music that really show the sort of emotion and the motive impact of Shenmue. But then, as I looked, I noticed that, wait a sec, apparently what the guy who is suggesting these things also thinks that the music from the Tomato Convenience Store is a great track. And I was thinking, wait a sec, how does that track go again? So I looked it up and, immediately gripped my head. This was such an annoying track. Essentially, there's a tomato convenience store in the game, and you go into it. In that game, you can buy an item, and then when you buy an item, you can, from the shop, you can enter in a raffle, and you put your hand in a box. There's a nice animation of you taking a raffle ticket out of the box, and then most of the time you'll lose, but sometimes you'll win, and that'll be kind of cool. And so it's very nice. This game also has you buying a drink from a vending machine and having a really long animation sequence where Ryo drinks the entire can. He never seems to need to go to the bathroom, though, either. So I spent some time in the tomato convenience store, also trying to not only buy items, but also there was this very nice little capsule machine where you put money into a capsule, turn the thing, and get capsules. And of course, some of them were Sonic the Hedgehog capsules, and I wanted all of those, and some were Virtual Fighter things, and I wanted all of those. And of course, the game is set in the 80s, despite of the fact that most of these characters were developed in the 90s. So there's a bit of in terms of tonal dissonance there. However, I kind of got hooked on that capsule machine, trying to get the ones I wanted, trying to get Super Sonic as well, because I got like Amy Rose and Sonic and Tails. I definitely got Tails, got a couple of versions of him. And actually, you end up able to sell some of those collections in the next game. But anyway, so as I played all these things, I was thinking, you know, I had this track play in the background that kind of drove me nuts. It was crazy, it was annoying, it was frustrating. So when someone was suggesting, hey, you know, this is a really great track from Shenmue, I was thinking, no, thank you. Okay, I'm not playing that track. Then during the Yu Suzuki thing, campaign to crowdforce Shenmue 3, Yu Suzuki was asked, what is your favorite track? And he mentioned the normal ones like Sedgeflower, Shenhua and stuff, which were fantastic orchestral tracks. And like I said, I played one of them earlier on, in a very early episode of the show. And then he said, but of course I have a very nice preference to the Tomato Convenience Store theme. And I think, damn it. Okay, Yu Suzuki, for no one else but you, I wouldn't do this, but for you, I'll do it. This is the Tomato Convenience Store. It was composed by one or more of Tanoki Mitsuyoshi, Yuzo Koshiro, Takeshi Yaganawa, and Osamu Murata, and or Ryo Tucci. It is from the video game Shenmue, which was developed by Sega, or technically AM2, because that's kind of what it was at the time. And I do really wish the best for this new version of Shenmue, this Shenmue 3, to continue the story, which will be developed by yusuzuki.net. So, without further ado, here is the Tomato Convenience Store theme. He asked for it. I hope you like it too. And with that, I'll leave you. So, this has been David Collins with BitNotes. If you can look at please check us out online. I've got a website at bitnotefm.com where you can listen to previous episodes. And also you can search for BitNote on your favorite podcasting service in order to have a listen and hope you enjoy. This is the Tomato Convenience Store. Yu Suzuki asked for it. You're going to get it. it played constantly.